Welcome to Discovering and Sharing Shuswap History. A bit of Salmon Arm history by Ellie McGaughey. As a new resident of Salmon Arm, I didn't think I knew nearly enough to take a project of writing about its past. However, the truth of the matter is I actually do know quite a bit of history about our little city, just by talking with some of the longtime residents. I have proudly become a member of the Shuswap Writers Group, SWG for short, established in 1988 by four women, Dorothy Rowland, Judy Remke, Ramona Rizzi, and Christine Peel. Dorothy is the only member from that group still active in the organization, but there have been and continue to be many members who have come and gone over the years. They adore sharing their knowledge about the city's history, and I thoroughly enjoy hearing the stories and bits of trivia they so enthusiastically reminisce about. Things like, and I'm sure many of you will remember when, the Shuswap Classic Theater used to be a bowling alley, Canadian Tire used to be a Zeller's, Shoppers Drug Mart used to be a co-op, Margaret Lund was the first female mayor of Salmon Arm in 1981. The Shuswap Association of Writers, not to be confused with the SWG, who are heavily involved with the association, has been hosting the Shuswap Writers Festival since 2004. The Shuswap Dance Center on the corner of Okanagan Avenue and 6th Street used to be a United Church, and then the Elks Club. These are just to name a very tiny portion of the changes Salmon Arm has morphed itself into during its growth. I wanted to go further back to the origin of this wonderful place I now call home and decided to do my research of the history of Salmon Arm on Wikipedia. I discovered the Sequatmik people, also known as the Shuswap people, occupied the region for thousands of years. September 1885, the Canadian Pacific Railway was laid. In 1890, the town, with a mere 28 people, obtained their very own post office. In the latter part of the 1890s, Salmon Arm's population had expanded to more than 200 citizens. 1904, fruit became the main export. 1905, May 15, Salmon Arm became an official city. 1913, electricity was introduced to the city. 1951, while on a royal tour, Princess Elizabeth and Prince Philip visited Salmon Arm. 1982, Prime Minister Pierre Trudeau, along with his three sons, passed through the city. They were confronted by three demonstrators protesting, among other things, the high unemployment rate. The PM gave them the infamous finger. I feel so blessed to have the wonderful opportunity every single day to observe the most magnificent bird of all, the bald eagle. Having a nest in a tree practically at my front door, I can witness firsthand how they build their nests and raise their young, the way they have been doing it for hundreds and probably thousands of years. Salmon Arm's own Roots and Blues Festival began in 1992 as a small indoor venue. The Apple Festival, held at the Ross Street Plaza, began September 26, 2015. There is also the Salmon Arm Fair that's been hosting a yearly event for the past 120 years, and next year I plan to attend all of these venues. It needs to be said, however, there is something the locals, the history books, or Wikipedia didn't have to teach me. They didn't have to teach me how beautiful, warm and inviting Salmon Arm is, not only in the landscape, but in the people who live here. That, my friends, is not something that can possibly happen overnight. It is, in and of itself, a huge part of the Salmon Arm history.
The first explorers visited and stayed in the Shuswap region 202 years ago in 1811. The goals for these fur traders were to find new sources of beaver pelts and to establish new trading routes. There was stiff competition between the Canadian Northwest Company and the American Pacific Fur Company headed by German immigrant John Jacob Astor, with the results influencing the future boundaries for the two countries. In previous years, the skilled surveyor and explorer David Thompson had been working his way down the Columbia River while establishing trading forts along the way in the Kootenays. His plan was to arrive at the mouth of the river to claim this area for the British. But concerns over potential clashes with the unfriendly Piegan Indians delayed his journey. Meanwhile, in early 1811, the Astorians, who were actually former Northwest Company men and British subjects, arrived at the mouth of the Columbia on the frigate the Tonquin and built Fort Astoria. When Thompson finally arrived in July to claim the area for the British, he found the Stars and Stripes flying above the new fort. The Astorians then outfitted an expedition headed by David Stewart to set up a network of interior trading posts. Thompson and Stewart headed up the Columbia River together, but Thompson with the lighter weight canoes pushed on ahead and at one point attempted to claim the area for British by paying one tribe to block the Astorians and by leaving a Union Jack and a written notice. Stewart and company had no problem convincing the Indians to let them pass, and they continued up the river to its junction with the Okanagan River. Near this junction, they quickly built a crude 16-by-20-foot cabin out of driftwood with a cellar where they stored 1,000 pounds of trade goods. In late September, David Stewart headed up the Okanagan River with three men and left Alexander Ross alone with his dog at the unfinished Fort Okanagan. Much of what we know today about these early days stems from the book that Ross wrote years later entitled Adventures of the First Settlers on the Oregon or Columbia River. Stewart had intended to return within a month, but winter arrived early and heavy snows delayed him. When he did arrive back in March of 1812, this account of his adventures, as quoted by Ross, provides the first written description of our region. Quote, "After leaving this place," said he, "we bent our course up the Okanagan due north for upwards of 250 miles till we reached its source. Then crossing a height of land, fell upon Thompson's River, or rather the south branch of Fraser's River. After traveling for some time amongst a powerful nation called the Shewaps, the snow fell while we were here in the mountains and precluded our immediate return. And after waiting for fine weather, the snows got so deep that we considered it hopeless to attempt getting back, and therefore passed our time with the Shewaps and other tribes in that quarter. The Indians were numerous and well disposed, and the country throughout abounds in beavers and all other kinds of fur. And I have made arrangements to establish a trading post there the ensuing winter. On the 26th of February, we began our homeward journey and spent just 25 days on our way back. The distance may be about 350 miles. While this account is sparse, much can be ascertained from it. Stewart no doubt traveled on a well-established Indian trail that later became the famed Hudson's Bay Brigade Trail that was used to ship furs south and bring supplies north. It later served as the route for moving horses and cattle and for the gold miners heading north. Ross's book describes countless attacks by the Indians along the Columbia, who often swarmed them whenever they traveled, while their descriptions of the Shewaps confirms later portrayals that they were primarily a peaceful tribe who helped these early traders get established here. As for Thompson, he never did see the river that was named after him by Simon Fraser. He did, however, in 1814, create the first map of the southern interior of this province, on which he labeled the Thompson River as Shewap River. He likely based his crude map with his grossly inaccurate depiction of the lakes on information from Stewart and Ross. And from this map and Ross's book, we now know how our region became known as the Shuswap.
Hello, my name is Ellie McGaughey, and I'm going to be reading to you stories and tidbits from the collection of local historian Dave Harper. He's been involved in local history for some 30 years now through the Salmon Arm Museum. Over the years, he's collected stories of Salmon Arm's origins and the people who settled here, both native and early pioneers. His interest here is in the individual stories of discovering a new land and how the landscape and geographical setting helped create a thriving, vibrant community. Some of our readings will be long, as they are memoirs of particular families, and yet there will be short little vignettes gathered from the pages of local newspapers, the Salmon Arm Observer, the Enderby Commoner, and the Inland Sentinel from Kamloops. So sit back and enjoy as we share an early history of the people who lived here. We start with lake history. This would be previous to 1884. 1815 to 1840, there is evidence that there may have been an HBC post at Glen Eden. French-Canadian Tom Snass was the first trader in the area. 1864, Hudson's Bay Post at Seymour Arm, Ogdenville, named after Charles Ogden, head of the Hudson's Bay Company operations at the time. Walter Moberly surveys route from Ogdenville to Big Bend Country. Tom Snass expands his Pierre's Point cabin to a two-story structure and clears about 15 acres. He also built a wharf. 1866, the SS Martin, a Hudson Bay steamer built in Chase by a Mr. Wright, is the first commercial boat to ply Shuswap Lake. She left Savona's Ferry on May 26 and arrived in Seymour Arm the next day. A letter to the Victoria Colonist newspaper describes the arrival. The steamer Martin came around the point and delighted the eye of every Seymourite as she glided through the noble waters of Shuswap Lake. 500 hungry pioneers about the time were partaking of their evening meal, bacon and beans, but at the sight of the steamer they hurriedly cast pots and pannikins aside, and soon the roar of the mighty cannonading was heard emanating from the efforts of the Royal Anvil Artillery. Three rousing cheers and a tiger rent the air. The passengers responded in kind. Speeches of welcome were made by the Semerites, but their efforts were as nothing to the response of the commander of the Martin, who caused champagne and HBC rum to flow freely for the benefit of all hands on board and of every individual who stood on the beach. March 6, Ogdenville, or Ogden City, renamed Seymour City and then Seymour Arm after Frederick Seymour, governor of the Crown Colony of British Columbia at the time. A contemporary account describes it thus. The population is about 500 and can boast of 6 saloons, 13 stores, 5 bakeries, 3 restaurants, 2 butcher shops, 11 shoemakers, 2 painters, 1 stationery shop, 6 physicians, a drugstore, 2 tin shops, 2 barber shops, 8 wash houses, and a bathing house. I might also mention an extensive fishery, 2 breweries, 2 blacksmith shops, and a livery stable, to say nothing of a coffee and donut stand. The beginnings. Since the first wandering tribes paused to camp on the Shuswap, the Salmon Arm area has been a treasured spot. For those first inhabitants, the region's value lay in the plentiful game and the creeks gorged with salmon in the fall. Later, with the incursion of the white trappers and traders into the area, the focus shifted to the large numbers of beaver, mink, and muskrat available. These were not to last, though. So the traders drifted on, and white farmers and loggers came to the harvest the rich land and forests. Not all of the traders left, however, and what follows is an account by Max Bedford of Salmon Arm's first white settler, Tom Snass. Tom Snass was gone before Salmon Arm proper really began. He was a unique example of a pioneer spirit which was to shape the future of Salmon Arm. It would appear that the first white settler in Salmon Arm was the French-Canadian fur trader known as Tom Snass and nicknamed Hey Moops, with a Shuswap guttural on the first syllable, meaning broad ass. The sequence of events would appear to be somewhat as follows. The Hudson's Bay Company set up its trading post at Kamloops about 1821. Sometime between 1821 and 1851, Tom Snass built his first log cabin at what is now known as Pierre's Point. In 1851, Tom moved to the Okanagan country, returning to the Shuswap within a few years. About 1865, he cleared some 15 acres of land and built a larger trading post about 100 yards southeast of the old cabin. Some years later, he built a two-story frame house with sawed lumber and the handmade square nails. This house was only a few feet from the log trading post and was connected to it by a covered walkway. Tom also planted about 3 acres of fruit trees. 3 old apple trees are still producing apples every August to the joy of the children at the beach. The original log cabin was about 15 by 20 feet in size and was roofed by shakes, each some 12 feet long, a foot wide, and 2 inches thick. 2 layers of shakes were used for each side of the cabin roof. If one examines the logs, it can be seen that a French-Canadian broadaxe with a round cutting edge was used to hew them. I think every other log cabin around Salmon Arm was made with the usual broadaxe with a straight cutting edge. Until about 1970, this building was still sound, rainproof, and usable. Tom also built an excellent wharf. This was 2 logs wide and about 100 feet in length, held in place by hand-driven pilings about 6 inches in diameter at the top. This wharf continued in use until the late 20s, as the writer recalls. The wharf was far superior to any wharf built at Pierre's Point since that time. Tom Snass built well, but little remains to mark the decades he lived at Salmon Arm, and the data about the man himself are even more fragmentary and elusive. When I grew up in Salmon Arm half a century and more ago, Wallenstein Lake in the Fly Hills was known as Snass Lake. Often, in the summer months, a group of young people would hike up the fire trail to the Granite Peak Lookout Station, where we would spend the night. Sometimes, on the following day, we would travel on a few miles to Snass Lake to do a bit of fishing. Carl Wallenstein was the finest of men, and it is fitting that a lake should be named in his memory, as was done by the Forestry Department, I think, during the 20s when they were adding names to their maps. However, it seems a shame that some other lake was not chosen so that the name of Salmon Arm's first white settler could have been commemorated by the lake which, for so many years, did in fact carry his name. So much for the bare bones of this report. Now let's add some flesh, some sinews, and ligaments to improve the articulation of the narrative. Shuswap means the big one, the chief, and first along its sprawling shores dwelt the Indians. Then came the explorers, like David Thompson, followed soon by the fur traders and trappers with a scattering of missionaries, and then the railroad in 1885, and the western tide of farmers, loggers, and merchants was soon in full flood. All of this in less than 100 years. So as far as this writer knows, only Tom Snass bridged the gap from fur trader to small farming in Salmon Arm. But the precise time of his appearance at Salmon Arm and the time and nature of his disappearance are not clearly known. There are some landmarks. When Harry Toma, an interviewee, was a young man, he had several discussions with an old Indian who remembered Tom Snass and his trading post well. In particular, he knew that Tom had left Salmon Arm in 1851 because this was the same year when he became married. And at that time, Tom had already been living, trapping, and trading from his log cabin for several years. In 1868, Tom began the clearing of his 15 or so acres. This can be determined today by anyone who wishes to take an hour or so to do it. At the north end of the clearing of the present Pierre's Point ballpark, the burnt stumps are still there, near the cabin. In fact, the wall of the cabin is still blackened from the fire which threatened to consume it. The proximity of the creek was probably all that enabled Tom and his people to save that cabin. In the fullness of the time, the burnt-over area was replaced by the grove of cedars, many of which are still standing, but a wide swath of these cedars was logged off in 1942 by the Salmon Arm Farmers Exchange, managed at that time by Ed Pike, and included a small sawmill in its operations. About 15 years ago, this writer counted the rings in a number of these cedars which sprang up after the land clearing fire. The rings averaged out to 74 per tree. Subtracting 74 from 1942 gives us the date of the fire, 1868, give or take a year or two. The burnt cabin logs establish that it was in existence at that time. Also, it would seem that Tom Snass had made an agreement with the three Indian chiefs, which enabled him to proceed with the land clearing and the building of the larger trading post. These were the chiefs of the three Indian bands which still inhabit the Salmon Arm of the Shuswap, namely Nisqually, the Adams Lake, and the Squilax bands. The Salmon Arm bands were fragments of the main bands which inhabited the main arm of the Shuswap and the first few miles of the Thompson River. For Tom to proceed with any large undertaking, he required the permission of the three chiefs of these bands, and there is evidence that he did get it, described as follows. British Columbia became a province of Canada in 1871. A few years later, 1876, I think, the boundaries of the Indian reserves at Salmon Arm were determined. This procedure was described to Harry Toma by Chief Celesta of the Squilax Band about 1910, when the chief was well on in years and Harry was a young man. The three chiefs and representatives of the Indian Department from Ottawa simply walked out the boundaries, slash marking the trees as they went. When they were covering what is now Pierre's Point, for the chiefs had said, "This cabin and this piece of land around it, some 15 acres, are not part of the reserve. They belong to the fur trader Tom Snass by our previous agreement with him." Harry Toma described this procedure and the Tom Snass claim to me about 1960. Sometime later, the land was surveyed and mapped, but according to Harry, the reserve was only an approximation of the boundaries, walked out by the three chiefs. "For example," said Harry, "the original boundary of the reserve was just east of the present Nunes Ironworks and took the ridge of land that runs north and south along Shuswap Avenue as the boundary." Possibly the Tom Snass claim was lost in this same way. The CPR came in 1885 and Tom passed on and the land was given to Pierre Moyes. When Pierre died in 1950, the land reverted to the Adams Lake Band, as I understand it. This saga of Tom Snass raises more questions than it answers. What manner of man was he? Where did he come from? Where did he go when he left the Shuswap, and what was the nature of his leaving? He got along well with the Indians. Did he take a wife and raise a family? No mention was made of this by any of my informants. But to this writer, there seems no doubt that this French-Canadian, Tom Snass, hey Moops, was the first white man to settle in Salmon Arm, coming when young and spending some 40 years of his life as frontiersman, trader, and tiller of the soil before the railroad arrived and opened the way for the homesteaders and merchants usually regarded as the pioneers and first settlers. The information for this report was obtained over the past 25 years from elderly Indians, including Christine Edwards of the Indian village at Chase, who died about 1960 at the age of 109, according to the Chase newspaper, but aged 118, according to some elderly Indians. She is the only person interviewed who had visited the Tom Snass trading post before the coming of the railroad in 1885. Unfortunately, while I knew Pierre Moyes, after whom Pierre Point is now named, he died in 1950, aged about 100 years. It was before I became interested in Tom Snass and his trading post, where Pierre was an assistant for many years. Christine Allen of the Indian Reserve near Salmon Arm died in 1977, aged 101. Harry Toma of the Squilax Band died a few years ago at about 70 years of age. My uncle Emerson Bowman, an early settler in Glen Eden, died in 1974 in his 100th year. In addition, there are my own observations gleaned from camping every summer from 1912 until 1976 at Pierre's Point. In fact, from 1938 until 1976, my lease line was only a few yards from Tom Snass's original cabin. 6 fur storage cellars had been built near the trading post. The last of these was leveled over about 1967 as it was located about where second base of the present baseball diamond is. At this same time, the orchard was leveled and the frame house was burned to make way for the present ballpark and picnic area. The logs of the big trading post had been carefully piled to the side as the Indians planned to reconstruct it and use it as a center for the Indian handicrafts. However, a local resident burnt the logs for firewood. Only a few of them were left. That ended the main trading post. In August 1962, John Alto found a carved inscription, EPI APL 1851, on a 4-foot boulder near Snass Lake. Photograph and story appear in the Salmon Arm Observer, September 20, 1962, front page. This is the earliest definitive evidence of a white man in the Salmon Arm area, yet no one marked the location of this historical boulder. The following summer, I took a group of young people, accompanied by one of the loggers who was there when the discovery was made, to search for this boulder. But logging crews had bulldozed through this area and we did not locate the rock. Possibly one of these days, it will once again be found. Now the date, 1851, is the year that Tom Snass left Salmon Arm for a time, and it is the most securely established early date that I have concerning Tom. Perhaps there is connection between the carved inscription and Tom Snass, which will come to light at some future time. Salmon Arm has not been free of setbacks, though. The Great Depression, the loss of its young men and women to world wars, the deep freeze of 1949-50 have all been tests of strength and resilience which our town has had to pass. With these trials and a history of steady growth behind them, the people of Salmon Arm may now take time to learn of and reflect on the characters and events which have given Salmon Arm area its unique flavor. The following excerpt was a speech given by Reeve E.C. Turner in 1955. I recall my father telling of the wood-burning CPR locomotives in those early days and how they used to stack wood in 2-foot lengths where the oil and gasoline tanks were now located across the tracks. It was a bit of a prize to get a CPR contract for about 100 cords at $2 a cord in those days. Most of the land was then in bush, of course. My father had 90 acres, and he and Nels Eklund had slashed about 10 acres each during the winter, ready for burning the following summer. They got more than they had bargained for. No sooner had they set fire to the slashing when a sudden gale blew up, and the fire spread east just past the present Skelton water tank near the present RCMP station. South as far as Merton Hill and north near Leech Hill. Everybody available fought fire. There were no fire permits then, quite different from today. This was in 1897 or 1898, before the municipality was incorporated. My father said his provincial taxes came to $2 a year, and he thought things were really getting expensive when they went up to $5. One thing strikes me about the general attitude of the people then, and that was the way they took time out to enjoy themselves. On one occasion, Dad and some friends went to Shoe Swap Station, the other side of Chase, to help someone they knew celebrate his birthday. When they got there, they learned someone else would have a birthday in a week's time, so they just stayed over. Then they used to go hunting on the Larch Hills for grousing in August, something you can't do now. They also went prospecting in the summer on Mount Bastion and Mount Ida. People really did turn out to exercise their right to vote then. There used to be a good-sized sawmill on the lake right below the present Cult Hill lookout point, and Dad said the fellows in the camp used to walk into town to the one polling station that was used for provincial and Dominion voting. My father and a fellow just out from England lived in a cabin in town. I remember him telling of their coming back to the cabin and finding a skunk had taken over. Dad's friend insisted on shooting the skunk with a shotgun, and what with the skunk reciprocating, not to mention hitting the scarce crockery, they had to abandon the place. May Day celebrations were held on the old City Hall grounds next to where the Anglican Church is now. The old City Hall was the first school. It served as school, City Hall, and jail. The jail was in the schoolroom section, and the City Hall was in the lean-to at the rear. If there was someone in the jail, usually on Mondays, then we got the day off. School classes were held in various places at that time, in the Orange Hall, beside Rivers Dairy. This site is now the Royal Walk Restaurant. Presbyterian Church, across from the courts. United Church, facing the cenotaph. Baptist Church, corner of Alexander and Harris, and the Finnish Hall, site of the Legion parking lot. I recall the first water pipeline to town going through Dad's place about 1913 or 14. It was dug by hand. I remember the wagon loads of pipe going up the hill for the Broadview water line. Ed and Ivor Peterson took a contract to dig that line by hand. It's hard to realize these things now in this machine age. Speaking of machinery, I remember when the municipality bought a gas engine road roller, about 8 or 10 tons, I think. The day it was being unloaded from the railway car, us kids went down to watch at recess time. When we got back, Jack Chambers, our principal, caught us getting in late and gave us what for. I believe the roller was broken up for scrap just before the Second War. After the Second War, events moved quickly, and this area, in keeping with most communities in BC, expanded and continues to face the problems that go with it. As I turn my thoughts to the future, it is in the great hope that Providence will spare mankind so that we can realize the tremendous possibilities of development in this beautiful setting of lakes and mountains. The Revelstoke to Kamloops stretch of the CPR was nicknamed the Lupala Division because there were so many Finns as foremen and section men from that part of Finland. Some people left their homeland to try to better their lot in Canada. Some, like loggers, mill workers, and other trades, were blacklisted in Finland because of joining unions. Two of the settlers at White Lake were sailors who left their ship to come here. Some moved in family groups, some having married in Finland, later getting established, leaving their families here. Finland was run by the Lutheran Church, and because there was no pity shown towards the helpless, most of the Finns who settled in White Lake wanted nothing to do with anyone or anything pertaining to religion. Education was very important, though, so as soon as possible they built a large school, which would also do duty as a hall as needed. This was submitted by Wilho Perry. The crew had to look after their section of track, a length of 6 to 8 miles, and they sometimes had to go further, and then they had to use the handcar. They had to clear the switches and renew ties, putting in new ties. They were sawn ties, square and 8 feet long. The foreman would have to go along in the fall and inspect his part of the section and count the ties that he figured needed to be renewed. Then a work train would bring them in the spring and unload them off the boxcar. They had to dig out the old ties. They went along to raise the whole track up and then pull the ties out. But they'd have to pull the spikes out first. But they were only allowed to take so many spikes out, you know, to keep the rails from spreading, in case there was a train that would come along. They worked 10 hours a day. When I started first off in 1911, when I was 15 years old, I worked shift hours, 10 hours a day, and I got 17 cents an hour. That was submitted by Matt Mackey. At the turn of the century, all the surrounding benchland had been logged over roughly, and the choicest of merchantable timber had been removed. The timber haul to the old mill pond would not be greater than a mile and a half. The hauling was done with horses, sloops, sleigh, and two-wheel dollies. Rough logs brought $8 per thousand at a mill pile. Loggers worked for $2 a day and paid their board from that. And good teamsters got $35 a month and board. All roads led downhill to the old mill pond, and no timber had yet been hauled uphill. The timber on the bench would be about two-thirds fir and one-third cedar. Thousands of ties had been made in this locality, and about the time of our arrival, French Canadians were doing expert work, some of them making from 60 to 100 ties a day by hand. To make the ties, the axeman had to fall his tree, limb it, score and hew it, mark it off in 8-foot lengths, and chop off the top, but he did not have to peel the ties. The axeman's work was then finished. Next came the swampers, who cleared through the brush and with a saw cut the hewn trees into sections of 2 or 3 tie lengths. A skidding horse would be taken on sleighs or wagons to be loading spur or siding or a convenient piling place beside the main line. There they would cut into single tie lengths and piled for inspection. Along in the summer, trains of flat cars would stop at the piles and a gang of men would load them. Of course, other trains could not pass while the ties were being loaded in this way. To be more correct, the tie trains were loaded when other trains were not moving and so did not interfere much with traffic. By Henry Calhoun.
Sternwheeler sternships were key to enabling the settlement of our amazing region. Before there were roads and automobiles, sternwheeler steamships served a vital role in the development of the Shuswap region. From 1866 until 1916, 19 stern and side-wheeled steamships were built to provide transportation between Savannah, the North Thompson, the Shuswap Lakes, and as far south as Fortune's Landing, now called Enderby. The ships ranged in size from the massive 133-foot, 307-ton Peerless built in 1881 with an engine salvaged from the Shuswap's first steamship, the Martin, to the 33-foot-long, 15-ton Red Star built in 1887. Shuswap steamships hauled supplies to the goldfields, carried men, equipment, ties, and rails for the construction of the railroads, hauled firewood, farm produce, and building supplies for the settlers, serviced the logging industry, and carried passengers. A number of boats were built in the late 1800s that provided service to Eagle Pass Landing near Sicamous and to the settlements along the Shuswap River, which was then known as the Spalmachine River. The small Kamloops I was built in 1872, and its most famous passenger was the region's first white woman settler, Mrs. A.L. Fortune. The 80-foot side-wheeler Spalmachine was built in 1878, and because its threshing machine engine was so noisy and its name was difficult to pronounce, she was known as Noisy Piggy. Also built in 1878, the 86-foot side-wheeler Lady Dufferin plied the waters until a fire in 1886, after which she was used as a tugboat until 1892. Two other boats were built to ship lumber and flour from the mills along the Shuswap River, as well as passengers and freight, the 33-foot Red Star I built in Victoria and the 57-foot Red Star II, which was built in Enderby. Time schedules were difficult to maintain, as the ships had to stop frequently for loads of cordwood, and during low water, the ships would often get stuck on sandbars. From 1880 until 1906, sawmills in Kamloops and Kalt, near Tappan, had virtual control of the Shuswap Lake benchlands through their timber berths that they held. These companies built most of the steamships to transport the loggers, horse teams, and equipment to the logging sites, and to tow the booms of logs to the mills. Logging was often done in the winter, with the snow facilitating the hauling of the timber. The logs piled up on decks along the shorelines, waiting to be rolled into the water and towed away in the spring. The two 90-foot sister ships, the C.R. Lamb and the Andover, were built for the Arrow Lakes Lumber Company in 1907 and 1908 for approximately $23,000 each. These vessels provided the greatest service to North and South Shuswap settlers. At first, the C.R. Lamb was the logging ship, and the Andover provided mail, freight, and passenger service, thanks to a $1,500 a month government subsidy. The government also assisted each community in the building of a wharf for both the steamships and private boats. Schedules and freight rates were published in the 1913 Chase Tribune. There were four classes of freight, with the fourth, grain, vegetables, and building supplies, the least expensive to ship, and livestock and farm implements, the most expensive. Passengers were charged 4 cents a mile, which meant a trip from Sulista to Kamloops was $2.28 per person, and shipping a box of apples would have cost just 90 cents. Sternwheelers were constructed with a shallow draft to avoid running aground on sandbars and to enable them to tie up on beaches. Sorrento pioneer Ted Cobo once recalled how these boats were handier than the trains. He said, "If we had goods to ship, we would simply wave a flag and Captain Ward would pull up to shore and load them up. He would even take boxes of apples and sacks of potatoes and trade them for flour and sugar. All of the supplies for our new house came by steamboat." By 1913, despite the excellent service and government help, the steamships became uneconomical. And in 1915, when many men left to fight in World War I, the service was discontinued. The Andover was briefly brought back into service in 1919 that included summer social outings with live bands. But by 1930, the combination of better roads and the economic depression brought the steamship service nearly to an end. In 1932, Billy Louie purchased the C.R. Lamb and ran it for 6 years. He had to petition the government to install a lift span on the Pritchard Bridge so he could provide service between Kamloops and Shuswap Lake. A dance floor was added to attract passengers for his moonlight cruises. But in 1938, the dilapidated ship was beached in Kamloops, and the sternwheeler era was over.
For more information on these and other stories, please contact the Salmonar Museum at Haney Heritage Park or visit us when we are open during the summer season.
My name is Dorothy Rolin. I'm the current president of the Salmonar branch of the Okanagan Historical Society. If you have stories or memories you'd like to share with this program, please call Voice of the Shuswap at 250-463-5026 or email info@voiceofthesushwap.ca. Discovering and sharing Shuswap history.
This radio program was made possible by a Government of Canada New Horizons grant, helping celebrate Canada's 150th anniversary.